I think a lot of poetry is about speaking back to power. You know, readers, you can only ask so much of them, right? I mean, and if you want them to focus their energy on, you know, the shimmering, gorgeous ambiguity of your finest imagery, you know, and you're also asking them to try to, like, figure out where the fuck they are, yeah. Then that's, like, a lot.
Welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast. I'm Bianca Stone, and I'm talking today with the poet Matthew Zapruder. Matthew Zapruder is the author of 5 collections of poetry, most recently Father's Day from Copper Canyon Press, as well as the amazing book Why Poetry, a book of prose from Echo House, HarperCollins. He's an associate professor at the MFA at St. Mary's College in California, and he's also the editor at large at Wave Books. Matthew, welcome.
Thanks, Bianca. It's great to see you.
So there's so much I want to talk to you about today, but I think at the core of everything we discuss is your actual poetry, which I find to be totally magnificent and unique. So I thought today we could start with you reading a poem before we launch into the larger discussion of poetry.
Sure. Yeah, well, I'll read a newish poem. This is something that kind of came out of, I think, a lot of experiences of staring at a screen, which we've all had. So I think it's more or less self-explanatory, I think. And I was on during the period of teaching online, I was also doing a lot of let's say committee work at my college where I teach. So I was on meetings the entire day, and it just got to the point where all I could do was like try to punch a hole through it was to write a poem. So this is the evening meeting. Finally, the hour has come. It is time for the long journey. I say to my wife and child a last farewell and click the blue button. My face appears across from my face. It is the day we will virtually discuss the unpredictable resolutions I'm sure obscurely will decide my fate. The ostensible chair begins to speak. Thank you for your electrons. I hope you're well in these days, or at least surviving. I touch the hem of a book. Someone says, that's a lot of togetherness. Someone says, the asymptote of dusk. The chair mutes us all. It's so good to see all your faces. Thank you for availing this interstitial complication to consider these extraordinary times. I put on my educator mask and stare into the unsmiling grid, trying to look as if I understand the one named after a star. She has mastered this new technology. She shares the document of potential paths through the forest into uncertain autumn. We talk and wander among them. We must decide but cannot stop. A great blanket of acknowledged despair, silence threatens until the one with all the hidden power speaks. His eyeglasses catch the light of an Akari. It is my sad role to remind you, yes, there are bodies piled in the streets, but don't forget the learning outcomes. Then the most mordant of us says, if I may quote my accountant, all solutions are suboptimal. Laughter ripples through the proximate squares. For a moment, we sit sensing vital decisions. Faces keep speaking. They dissolve and become shapes on my screen. More and more, they resemble lonely ships carrying vital protocols into the distance. The voices get further away. At last, the endless meeting ends. I begin to recite the ever more infinite list of things I do not know.
Totally captured it. Oh my God. I love, there's so much I love about this. A, that you're like, okay, I'm gonna make something creative out of this, like, creativity vortex, like, vacuum. And I love the sardonic tone of that, but also the true beauty that did come out of it. But also what strikes me in that poem is what strikes me in a lot of your poetry, which is this this endless, really relentless self-investigation that seems to be happening with you concerning like how poetry works and doesn't work, how we relate to one another in the world and how that works in poetry itself. But I guess just generally, do you find poetry to be a work of self-investigation?
I do. I think, I mean, without being overly dramatic, I mean, I think it's a survival mechanism. Mm. I mean, a big part of that is self-examination because, you know, I think, you know, like if you just take this poem, I mean, it's, you know, a lot, I think a lot of people can relate to being in this situation, whatever their careers are, whatever their jobs are, you know, or just even family life or whatever, like all this performing we were doing online and staring at our own faces while we're doing it. It's so, it's, you know, dehumanizing basically. And like, I felt dehumanized. I felt like everybody was dehumanized constantly. And the only way I could think of personally to push back was to try to make something out of it, you know, like to try to go into it. And I mean, there was a part of me that was like, I'm pretty sure the world doesn't need like another poem about being on Zoom. Like, a lot of things.
We're just starting writing these poems. Maybe it does need them.
That's true. But I mean, it wasn't like, I wasn't necessarily thinking, the world needs this so badly, right, or whatever. I was more thinking, I need to survive this experience. And the only way I can do it, I mean, I can complain to my friends, I can text, I can, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or I can like go in, like take the language and start torquing it and messing with it and see what's there to try to survive. And like, you know, basically it made me feel better, but it made me feel like all this time doing this wasn't wasted. You know, that I learned something, I guess.
Yeah.
Even if I can't say exactly what I learned, you know, I mean, I don't know that poem has like a message or anything exactly, except that we're kind of, you know, in a weird situation, but.
Yeah, I mean, it does sort of point to the fact that we don't have a lot of control over the life that we live, the situations we find ourselves in that aren't great and vivid and like full of, you know, creativity and life and fun. But that poetry isn't made just to explore the like good, interesting.
I think a lot of poetry is about speaking back to power, kind of carving out a private space or an independent space or a resistant space or like just a free space, you know, whatever that word free means. We could spend a long time talking about that, but like, you know, but this is like, I think just, you know, me pushing back in a way that I think like a lot of people want to push back, you know, right? You know, and this impulse is I'm sure is in all of us, you know? And so it's just, I indulged it. I have a way of indulging it. And I do feel, and to the extent to which I feel like it's useful, I mean, I do think it's, you know, if you create that space, it is available to other people if they want it, you know? So it's not a totally selfish, I mean, yes, it isn't. So I guess there's a long way of answering your question. It's like, yeah, totally. It's about self-investigation. And I'm interested in investigating the self and being kind of like, in a way, like ruthless with myself.
Yep.
You know, but also, you know, I'm interested in hopefully along the way, making spaces that are available for other people to kind of be in and be separated from the things that are, you know, assaulting them essentially, you know. You know, that when a poet does that, it might be remind people that they can also do that.
Right.
So they can talk back even in their minds to themselves. I mean, to me, like, you know, there's always in this poem, and you know, there's always somebody with more power who keeps revealing himself, you know. It's like there are these levels of like, you know, who has the real power. And that's true, certainly in academia. You know, there's like, you know, it's such a hierarchical feudal system, and there's always some system of power that you're barely aware of unless you've been at an institution for like 3,000 years. You know, there's somebody who's like actually got the fingers on the lever of power to whatever extent that matters. That punk part of you that just wants to be like, fuck you, you know, I can tell a joke about somebody and like push back against the person who's like the chair and the authority figure is like, you know, I think that's pretty good. Like, that's a good role for poetry too, you know.
Absolutely.
Like flipping the bird, just like right straight into the face of like the authorities.
I know, I had this away. I did have this feeling that the, you know, I was reading that poem and I was like, this is totally like flipping the bird to the like chairman. And I was like, I wonder if he's like reading Matthew's poems and like probably not, but there's a delight in being like, and you can't do anything about it because this is poetry. Yeah. This is not like in the New York Times as like an ed, you know, op-ed or something.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I did. I mean, I've written. I got into this thing where I was writing these tanka, you know, whatever the that five line.
So what's a tanka?
The five line Japanese form. Yeah, so it's a haiku, and then there's 5-7-5, and then there's 2 7 syllable lines that follow it, and it's tanka are the basis of a collaborative Japanese writing practice that's Renga, that's existed, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years. And, you know, Basho and all their Japanese poets were Renga masters, and haiku was kind of pulled out of Renga. Haiku was the first three lines of a Renga. So it wasn't all, you know, it became an independent literary form, haiku. Mm-hmm. But initially it was just the beginning, it was the beginning, it had pride of place as the beginning of a Renga. So people would, you know, you, me and Ben and like, you know, would get around and drink little cups of wine. And for hours we would write a Renga, and I would write, you know, three lines and you'd write two, and then Ben would write three, and then I'd write two, and blah, blah, blah. So around. And there were lots of conventions and lots of, anyway, so tanka is a kind of like extended haiku sort of five line thing. And so I wrote a lot of tanka for my English department, which are extremely, you know, biting. Now that I'm a full professor, I can publish them wherever I want, and nobody can do anything about it. But it was again just like a way of pushing back, right?
Right.
Like so frustrated.
It's so ironic because so many of us poets, are like desperately searching for this teaching job in academia, and it's so highly competitive and put so much work into it, and then it's like you get there and you're like in prison.
It's a special kind of prison, academia, because obviously, you know, of course it's, you know, and we need healthcare, and you know, you get money,
right,
and you get off time off or whatever, but like, you know, academia has become not our daddy and mommy's academia, let's just put it that way. I mean, there's a lot of demands on professors, you know, we were talking about a little bit before this, and you know, but there's just a lot of, they expect a lot out of you. And so it's like, you know, but whatever, I mean, it's a job. You know,
yeah.
They pay you. So, but some complaining is definitely in order too, you know.
My cat.
Cat.
Christ. God forbid I close the door.
I was gonna bring my dog in here, but I figured that would go not well. So, hey, Kit, what's your cat's name?
This is Ladybird.
Oh,
Ladybird. She's a beast. Took her to the vet. They checked overweight in the overweight box.
Oh, you don't look overweight to me. You just look delicious.
Yeah. Well, you want to eat my cat?
I gotta do right now. She's pretty cute. It's been, you know, but yeah, the writing, I mean, I'm trying to stay away from like becoming an academic poet, you know, poet who complains about academia in his poems. That'd be a dark fate.
Yeah, it's too late. You've got a whole series of tankas about it. So
yeah, they will probably remain in my computer, but on my typewriter. So
this is something I've been thinking a lot about in terms of like teaching and working on people's manuscripts, but you wrote that one of the beneficial side effects of writing poetry to cement things in my memory. And then another time you wrote, I don't keep a journal. So for me, poems are often the way that I can not only preserve a certain time, but also get more deeply into my experience of that time itself. How do you see memory working in poetry? I see so many students struggling with, we'll say, memoir impulses in poetry. I think the second part of the question is, how do you balance information giving in poetry? And I think that's also narrative, and negative capability or attention to absence of information. It can be really confusing to talk to students about this. I find it hard to articulate to them that like, I need more information. I'm confused about what's happening in this poem. Plus like you have too much information in here. And it's like, so I'm like, I want ambiguity, but like, I don't like being confused. So.
Yeah. I mean, I know exactly what you mean. And it's tough because, you know, it's like, sometimes, I mean, I'd say not just with students, but my own work, I mean, I'm being confusing in the wrong place, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
I guess. And so it's like, you know, there's certain, I mean, you can't make rules about it, right? But like, there's certain things that it's not, almost always, it's not a good idea to be like, unspecific or confusing or ambiguous about something boring, like for instance, like where am what room am I? Am I like, am I in a museum or am I flying an airplane or am I cooking dinner? Like, I mean, that's not a particularly interesting thing to be confused about unless your poem is productively shimmering between being in an airplane and cooking dinner. You know, in which case, then. You know, everything I said is not true, but I mean, you know, usually that's not the case. I mean, usually it's just somebody's doing something and they just haven't, you know, and I mean, it's really going to sound ridiculous, but I mean, I've had this conversation 5,000 times with students where I'm like, way more than 5,000 times, but like, what would you, like, let's say you were going to title this poem in the most explicit way possible. Like, what would you call it? You know, or you talk to them for 20 minutes and then you realize they're like, you know, this poem is, you know, hiking to my grandmother's grave through the tall grasses of Goshen.
Right.
You know, and you're like, what if you just called it that?
Yeah.
Like, that would get rid of like 80% of like the stuff that, and because I always say to myself and to other people, I'm like, you know, readers, you can only ask so much of them, right? I mean, want them to focus their energy on, you know, the shimmering, gorgeous ambiguity of your finest imagery, you know, and you're also asking them to try to like figure out where the fuck they are.
Yeah.
Then that's like a lot to ask someone to do. And it's maybe not, I'm not going to say it's never useful or it's never artistically productive. I mean, you know, I mean, there are cases where it is, but it's just, you know, it's a good idea to at least try out not being confusing about certain aspects of things and see if it really does ruin your poem. And usually it doesn't, you know. So I don't know if that really answers your that's about being information. That's addressing your second question, which is about bouncing information or whatever. And you know, it's we're trying to think of an example, you know, it's I guess for me the best, I don't like my poems unless there's something in them that I don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, unless there's something in them that's truly like feels like I'm really reaching.
Yeah.
And it's really like kind of, you know, beyond me in a way, but I can't get there without, you know, if the whole thing is like that, it's tough for me. You know, it's like, it's almost like that's the jewel. And like everything around it is a kind of like encasement for it. And so, you know, I don't wanna have the whole thing be just like falling apart all the time, you know. But that's just me. And that's not, you know, it's not for everybody. But...
Well, it's interesting because your poetry does, I feel like you are very good. And I've seen this sort of evolve and get more clear in your work is you say things in the most straightforward way possible to the point where it becomes really strange how specifically accurate you've set us up into what's happening, like and then but somehow within that then we're able to have more strange lyrical embellishments within that, but there's something so grounding, almost robotic about the directness with some description, and then but then you that offers seems to offer you so much more room for play and ambiguity.
Yeah, well, part of it is that I like the way regular quote unquote language sound. I mean, ordinary, whatever, it's all being in quotes, but like conversational language or direct language, very direct language sounds.
Yeah.
I like the sound of that. It appeals to my ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm going to say something super obvious, which is that different registers of language appeal to different ears. And, you know,
yeah,
Gerard Manley Hopkins or Hart Crane or even some of them, you know, a poet I adore, Sylvia Plath, you know, the thing that appealed to their ear was probably something that generally speaking was, you know, a bit higher register, you know, than what appeals to my ear. I just, it's just something a little more close to conversational language just appeals to me. And it's just, you know, you know, it's just, it's almost like a personality thing and it's not a value judgment, but can I read you something?
Yes.
Because you were talking about, so, you know, direct language or like, you know, what you think of as like almost robotic. And I would call it like, sort of maybe like highly, almost like parodically logical language. Mm-hmm. And like, this is something that I took from, you know, I learned how to do this from a certain group of poets, you know, from Eastern and Central European poets of the 20th century. I mean, they all, whether you talk about Szymborska or, you know, Vasco Popa or Miroslav Halab or Tomasz Szalaman, you know, and in different ways, they all, and, you know, kind of were in that, they or speaking of Herbert, they all kind of played with this, like, I don't want to say official language, but kind of like very flat, like logical language. And they would sort of push against it and play with it or whatever. And also, you know, certain, you know, poet like Janis Ritsos does the same thing in a lot of ways. But anyway, but this is a poem by Vasco Popa that's everybody know, a lot of people know this poem, but it's, but I know when you were saying that, I was thinking about the Little Box poems. Do you know those poems? The Little Box. This is translated by Simic, actually.
It sounds very Simic.
Serbian poet Vasco Popa. And so this is, and he has this, and so Popa writes poems, a lot of his poems are in series, you know, so he'll write a bunch of poems around the same kind of subject. And these poems are called, the Little Box is the name of the series or whatever. And so the first poem is called The Little Box. And this is translated by Charles Simic. The Little Box. The Little Box gets her first teeth. And her little length, little width, little emptiness, and all the rest she has. The little box continues growing. The cupboard that she was inside is now inside her. And she goes bigger, bigger, bigger. Now the room is inside her, and the house, and the city, and the earth, and the world she was in before. The little box remembers her childhood, and by a great, great longing, she becomes a little box again. Now in the little box, you have the whole world in miniature. You can easily put it in a pocket, easily steal it, easily lose it. Take care of the little box. So like that kind of like almost like.
God, I hear that stern poem. I'm like, that's the kind of poem that makes me, and it's kind of interesting because it kind of relates to the first part of the question about memory and trying to be narrative. And there's something, I hear that poem, I'm like, that's the kind of poem I want to write about my mother or something, you know?
Right, like, exactly. Yeah.
Like you're like, oh shit, that's how I should have done it. Like, not like tell the story about what happened. Like,
it's, I wouldn't say it's an either or thing, but I would say that that rechannels that narrative impulse into a kind of like, let's say, rhetorical or logical impulse. It's almost like a logical proof. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that those, the Eastern and Central European poets I mentioned, they have a kind of like almost like parodically logical way of moving through the poem, like this then. But of course, the movement from the this to the then is so fucking weird and like, yeah, you know, and like intuitive and associative or whatever. I mean, Szymborska has that. I mean, her poems seem like, people love her poems because they think they're simple, mm-hmm, but they're actually like super weird.
That's my favorite.
Sorry, yeah, of course, so we love that. No, we love that. That's the thing. Of course, okay, we love that. It's like crystal clear, right? And it's like, so you know, that was mind blowing for me and my peers, mm-hmm, because we were coming up in the 1990s at a time when people were not writing poems like this. So we found this work, mm-hmm, written by Vasco Popa, by Tomasz Szalaman, by Zbigniew Herbert. This is before Szymborska won the Nobel Prize. This, all these poets, you know, Anna Swier, like a lot of poets, right? And we passed it around like fucking, you know, like holy,
yeah,
you know, holy text.
What is this?
Because it was like, oh, you can write this way. And you know, one of the first people who kind of metabolized this was Matt Rohr. He made it his own.
Mm.
And he was the first, I feel like he was almost the first poet of my generation of poets born in the 60s and early 70s.
So like, the generation influenced by your generation.
Well,
sorry.
So he was the first one in his book, A Hummock and the Malukas, which won the National Poetry Series while he was still at Iowa. Mary Oliver, mm-hmm, picked it. And that's a great book. I mean, it's, mm-hmm, still a great book.
It is.
He took this, I think he would agree, be the first to agree that he learned something about, you know, how to move through a poem, but kind of made it American, I guess I would say, you know, made it a poem written by an American in their 20s, as, mm-hmm, opposed to a, you know, Serbian in his 40s or whatever, 50s, no. But not that they're that different, actually. I mean, you could see this poem. That poem I read, you could see it in a literary magazine now for sure, right? I mean,
I think it's, if you're asking if it would be relevant and liked, I think it would be. Yeah, I would be thrilled, but I would be excited to find that poem.
But I'm not sure that would have been true in 1994.
No, you know, it's when I first... When I first met you in 2006... somewhere 2008 maybe.
It was closer to six.
I was like, what the fuck is this poetry? Like you and Rohr and stuff. I was like, it's funny now because it's so, now it's like the way I write too, or I've integrated it into the way I write, but like then it was actually, I forget how strikingly different the tone was and how I had to really readjust my mind to be like, oh, I get this. Cause it's easy to sort of be like, when you're used to the way, like then I grew up,
yeah,
with my grandma was like a poet of the 80s and 90s, like that, but she was like in her 80s then, but like still that was the poetry that I grew up with. So it was a really hard shift mentally, but now I feel like it's very integrated into my generation's work. But that's interesting because I'd never really thought of it as coming from there. I always thought it came from Ashbury. And
We loved Ashbury, but I don't actually think it came from Ashbury. I mean, I think that, I mean, we worshiped Ashbury,
but right,
you know, definitely we're taking a lot from him. But actually, I think really what was going on is that, I mean, I would never say that we were reacting against him because I'm, you know, a massive Ashbery fan, but I think it was, I mean, it's very complicated to generalize about this stuff, but I would say that, and I'm talking about the dominant literary culture at this time. There was all kinds of other poetry being written in the 90s, mm-hmm, and all kinds of other venues and all kinds of other communities. Right. that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I'm talking about just like sort of stuff that won prizes and stuff that was published in the Paris Review and stuff that was published, you know, in the New Yorker, that kind of thing. I think that the general feeling was that a directness, a certain kind of directness was highly unfashionable and felt, and I remember when I was writing, you know, and starting to write, really being like mocked, basically, to be honest with you, like by people who thought that I was like not smart.
Right.
No, but I bet you, like,
that's what honestly, the first thing I thought was that didn't sound smart. That was, yeah. I'm not you talking about it, you. I'm
no,
not
no, even you know about what? You, it doesn't sound smart. Yeah, that's exactly
it,
right.
Right. I remember reading a line. I don't remember who wrote it, but it was just, I'm so sad. That was like one of the, like in the middle of the poems, like, I'm so sad. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, why? Like, it's almost like an anti, but that directness, that bluntness, well, also there was like a lot of irony at work there too. And it was all about tonality too, but like, you have to like,
shift you know your what's funny about that is that that's always been there in American poetry. I mean, like, you know, that just makes me think of, you know, one of my, you know, in Wallace Stevens' first book in Harmonium, you know, there's that poem Gubbinol, and I think the lines are, the world is ugly and the people are sad. That's a line. So it's always been there. It's like this kind of like American language. And like, I wasn't like Matt and Joshua and I and others we weren't inventing something new. We were just, I think we were tapping into a strain of American poetry. And you know, it's funny about it too, is like, so my teacher and was James Tate. My main teacher was James Tate. I also studied with Aga Shahid Ali and Dara Wire, with two amazing poets and amazing teachers. But so, Jim was kind of like the big name there, obviously famous poet there. But he was going through a little bit of a dip in his reputation at that point. Not huge, but I mean, he wasn't like, I don't think he would have been brought up as being the main guy at that point or whatever. But he was about to come back into this. You know, he's about to publish Worshipful Company of Fletchers and then Shroud of the Gnome. And like, those books were huge. And I think they won National Book Awards, and one of them won the National Book Award. But anyway, but, you know, it was like, he's always written in that very direct way. I mean, since the beginning, you know, his poetry has been super straightforward. And he's got that kind of Midwestern flat, like hilarious American diction, you know, that like, he's always written that way. So like, I was really lucky to study with him, because I can imagine having ended up in other environments, you know, where I would have been studying with poets who I didn't actually relate to their what they were interested in terms of registers of language. But Jim was like right there for me. That's how you do it. You
know? Yeah, he's a big one. Oh, it's just so. He too. I was like, I remember, I thought The Lost Pilot was Tate, and then I like read his other books, and I was like, "What is? There's something so."
Well, it's like that great. I mean, I've actually looked at this earlier today. It's like it's this great long poem called "Fuck the Astronauts," which is like so good, and it's like completely sounds like, you know, Breton. Like, it's total like surrealist, like. You know, it's like talking about an angel. It's like angel smoking a cigarette on the steps of a bank, and then it's like an angel smoking a bank on the steps of a cigarette. You know, whatever. Like, it's kind of like he's just going off. He doesn't give a. She does not give a fuck.
He doesn't give a fuck. That's the thing.
Give a fuck. Yeah. He's like, I'm doing this because it's you know, it's poetry. He's like an addict. He's just like looking to score like the next poetry hit. And he doesn't care what he has to do to get it. And it's like, it's relentless. And I just, but I mean,
you know what?
He's the best.
It's like, my brother is really into Tate, and he'll like be like, Bjug, come listen to this poem. And he'll like read me this like 5-minute poem. And I'll just be like, got it. I'll be like, I give up. Like, I can't even like... compete. And you know, you hear,
well, yeah,
no, I know, whatever, you, then you're like, whatever, I'm great.
I'm just saying it's like Tate is, you know, he is very intimidating. I find him intimidating, his poetry intimidating, you know. It's like, it's really, you know, I can only read it in certain moods, you know. But I mean, coming back to, you know, what we were talking about, like diction, you know, I mean, you know, like, I mean, you know, later on, I came across a poet like James Schuyler, who I had
yeah.
no idea existed when I was writing, you know, when I was first starting to write poems. Like, I'd never, I mean, I think it probably, you know, at some point I read David Lehman's book, and then about the Last Avant-Garde, and then, of course, like, you know, and then I was like, oh, it's Schuyler. And now it's like one of my favorite poets. But
yeah,
it's like, I don't, my point is like, it's a little bit, you know, I also feel this way about surrealism too. It was like, I kind of stumbled on my own like quarter-assed version of it.
Yeah.
And I was sort of working in this area. And then I was like, and then I found these other poets who had been doing this same work for a long time, or maybe even were dead and had done it for a long time. And it was like, I was like, oh, like I'm just like scratching at the corner of a little like piece of construction paper here with my little crayon. And they're like, you know, and so it was, really, but yeah, I remember when we were, when I taught your NYU class, I mean, that was a funny thing. Cause I guess it was, who was it? It was your teacher. It was,
Susan Stewart.
Yeah. And she had laryngitis. She like couldn't.
Yeah. She like couldn't talk.
She had a health thing. Which she couldn't,
yeah.
She couldn't teach. So I came in like a month in and I taught.
We had like two classes with her, and then waltzed in, and I was like, "Who's this guy?"
Waltzed in. I was like, I was called, you know, whatever.
You were like,
called up from the minor leagues, you know, like
totally. Well, you were like walking injury. Across the Sixth Avenue from the new school, like coming over to the NYU, and we're all.
And
like,
it was fun, but it was funny because you guys were.
We had written these formal poems, and like you came in and you were like, what are these fucking kids doing writing these like
well the
funny thing about,
but the, that wasn't the issue. It wasn't the formal poems. It was the issue. It was that I think there was a kind of what I noticed, and I really noticed this with you was, and you know, you were really young. I don't know how old you were at the time, but I mean, like, you know, but and it was like, when I looked at you and your friends, I was like, you all are like in your 20s. You're living in New York, you're probably like having the best time ever right now.
Totally.
Like, and but you write like you live like in the forest.
Yeah.
With like a bunch of 9,000-year-old gnomes. And like,
I know you were
it was interesting because it was like we all have to do that with every single person who writes poems has to get out of there like. Little but out of their literary idea of like what a thing of what a poem is, everybody has to do that.
Yeah,
nobody's true. And so we all carry these things in, and like, you know, and I had my version of that too that was probably frankly a lot less skilled than the version you had that you were doing, but like, you know, but it was interesting because I was like, I mean, guys, like you know, you're not writing who you are, you know, like in the world. And then once you started, I mean, I'm going to take credit for it, but like once you all, you know, I mean, your poems and Kathy's poems and other people's poems, and they're just like blew up.
Yeah.
You guys were like, you know,
it was brutal. You know, it was actually does kind of remind me of therapy because like there's some times that are just so brutal and you have so much resistance and you have to like kill something. It's like facing something. Like there was something very intense about my experience when you came, and like because I think what I realized is I wanted so badly to change, and seeing the possibilities of poetry that I thought I knew everything, and I realized that I only knew like a tiny corner. It was really brutal. And so then there was this period of time of experimentation that felt really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But it changed my life. Like.
Yeah, but but there was a whole scene. I mean, it makes it seem like I'm taking credit for this whole thing, but I think it was part of a whole thing that was happening in poetry that was like things were opening up in a certain kind of way at that point that was really, and a lot was changing really fast. I think then, and it was exciting. And I remember I introduced you to the folks at the new school.
Yep.
And then you all hit it off. And then suddenly you had your own community and you were all doing all these things, and you accelerated way past me super fast, you know. And it wasn't like, you know, it was just a matter of like being given permission probably to just, you know, to just, you know, but yeah, I mean, I remember actually, I think now as a teacher, I would be much more gentle in that situation than I was. But I think I got frustrated at a certain point. I was like yelling at you, like not yelling at you, but being like, stop writing like an 80-year-old man.
I know.
Because we were talking like, stop writing like Galway Kinnell.
I know.
Not that I have anything against Galway Kinnell. He's great, but he's also, it's like, you know, wasn't Bianca Stone. You know?
Right.
And like, it's, but that's easy for me to say, because I'm not, it's not my.
Well, that's what teachers. Yeah, but I always feel guilty going in like teaching now too, because I'm like, kind of the same where I'm like, okay, well, I want to be nurturing. I don't want to be a dick. I want to respect where people are coming from, what they're trying to do. But at the same time, I'm like, you're limiting yourself so much. And I know it's going to be hard to hear, but like, don't you want to be free? Like, don't you want to like, write? It's also like, well, okay, well, what's working? Is this working for you? Like, are you writing good poems? Like, are you writing poems that people want to read? Or are you just writing sort of like,
well, are you writing poems that you want to read? I mean, like, I mean, I feel like in, you know, and you do have to, obviously, as a teacher, one thing, you know, I think we all learn as we get further on is to really calibrate our, you know, reactions based on what students are kind of like, what they're ready to hear, you know, like, I mean, different people are in different spaces, different times. And I mean, I think it was easy to perceive that you were a strong individual, like in that moment. So we could talk in a certain kind of way, you know, and I could be like, you know, like you were ready to change and you wanted to, and you were trying to, but it was just like, you just needed somebody to give you permission. So,
well, like, also to, I was like, I read The Pajamas and I was like, holy shit, I want to write like this. Like, I really thought that, like, I was like, this is exciting me in a way that I, you know, was very new to me. I hadn't even read Ashbery at that point, you know, like I was reading Ashbery for the first time, but I didn't feel like I could write, like get in with like writing anywhere near like Ashbery.
Well, so of crazy. Course you can't, like, because I can't write like him either. I mean,
yeah, you know, no, Ashbery, and it's not, like, I'm not saying I can write like you either.
No, but I
felt more let into your poems. Like your poems, I read your poems now and I'm like, I want to write a poem after I read a Matthew Depruver poem. Like,
well, we're closer in a lot of ways. I mean, Ashbery, you know, is you know, in so many ways. I mean, he was really just so deep in a certain kind of aesthetic of the 50s and 60s that was, you know, and have to do with art and like,
right,
a certain kind of queerness, I guess I would say, that is very, you know, that O'Hara has too, that like highly, ironic isn't maybe the right word, but like self-conscious, performative. It's extremely intelligent all the time, I feel like. And it's like, you know, it's just a very high level. And I love Ashbery. I adore. And when I read an Ashbery poem, I want to write like him. But I'm so different from him in my body, in my experience, like who I am or whatever. It wouldn't make any sense for me to write like Ashbery. You know, there are little bits and pieces of Ashbery that I, you know, that drift into my poems, I'm sure, because he had such a, but it's the same thing with Tate, right? You know, it's like he's, you know, I can't write like him. I mean, he's a Midwesterner who grew up in a Pentecostal household and was like, and his brain is different. And so, you know, so I think, but it's like when you're teaching, or when you run into a teacher or a peer or somebody, you know, sometimes enough of you overlaps to like change you and or to allow you to change yourself. And I'm sure that, you know, happened for you and me. That makes sense, you know, and it happened for me and other people. You know, right. and it is great when it works. It's really, I mean, I'm very proud, you know, that, you know, when I look at your poems and I see your work, I think you write great poems. And I think you totally go for it. And they like have like tons of energy and they're super honest and they're really funny. And you know, I always know your poems when I see them. And like, I think you're a terrific poet. And like, so to the extent to which I could like, you know, pour fuel on that fire, I'll take that as a win, you know. Like, you know, I can't take credit for it, but I can take credit for having poured an accelerant on a flame that was probably going to burst out anyway. But like, you know,
well, that's an interesting part of, I mean, teaching. I always, when I think of you, I think of how amazing you are as a poet, but how amazing you are as a teacher too, and the way that you think about poetry. You write a lot about poetry. You've been on fire writing about poetry. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I got this idea to write this Y poetry book, and it was kind of this, like, you know, I always like writing prose because it kind of like scratches this itch that I have of like, can I like work my way through an idea in a certain kind of way that I, you know, that I don't really do in poems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's just a different kind of space for me that I like to do with my brain. But I just got this idea. I was like, oh, you know, I've said so many times, and I've heard other poets say so many times, like, you know, like I can't explain my poems. Right? Poetry, you just have to read it. And, you know, right. And yeah. Like, and I, there is like a lot of truth to that, you know,
mm-hmm.
But I was like, what if you did try to explain it?
Mm.
Like, what would it be? What would happen? Yeah. And I just couldn't shake that idea. I was like, I couldn't get it out of my head. I was like, what would happen if I did that? What would happen if I did that? And so finally I just started. And I originally did it actually as a lecture at the Tin House.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a lot about Ashbery actually.
Yeah.
And I gave this lecture one summer that I was at Tin House. And I was like, oh, there's something here. Like there's something to write about here, you know, and there's a lot more to say and a lot more to get into. And I was just like, okay, I'll just let this impulse go and see what happens, you know? And so I ended up writing this book, but it was very much like a dare to myself almost.
Yeah.
I was like, can I talk about poetry and not be full of shit?
Yeah.
Basically. That was more or less like the dare, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know, I think that there are problems with the book for me. There are things that I didn't explain or dig into as much as I would have liked. You know, but I all knew when I was writing it that it was going to feel like it's impossible. It's like you can't cover everything. But yeah. Like I do think that I don't think that there's any bullshit in that book. Like right. I don't think there's any like, you know, saying stuff about poetry that just like sounds good or like plays into some idea we have about it or something. You know, I think it's an honest attempt to engage with hard topics. And like, so for me, I was like, you know, it was hell to write it. And I wrote a lot of it like when my kid was born. So I like literally wrote a lot of the draft like with him like on sleeping on my lap, you know, or like right there, like I was typing over him or whatever, because that was
mm-hmm.
And so that was weird and kind of been cool and felt somehow like so, I don't know what the right word is. It felt so extreme.
Yeah.
and so I liked just sort of pushing myself in that way too, you know, my mind, pushing my brain as far as I could in that way. And I learned a lot about writing. And but then I was like, oh God, I'm never gonna do that again. Like that's horrible. Like all I want to do is write poems. Like I did not want to ever be talking yeah. like that again. And then but I got sucked back in and now I'm fucking doing it again. And it's like I don't know. Now I'm writing another prose book. And it's like, ugh, why do I do this to myself? You know, it's tough.
Yeah. Do you worry that that's gonna like take away from your poetry or anything? Like I always feel like a little, because I've suddenly got the prose bug too. And I'm like, I should be writing poems. I'm like, I just want to write about poetry right now. Like,
it doesn't take away. I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't for other people. It might, but it doesn't, because honestly, like for one thing, I mean, with Why Poetry, I just ended up thinking so much harder about some poems and mm-hmm. how they work. You know, even poems that I thought I knew pretty well, you know, just digging in. I mean, just like going almost like practically like syllable, but phoneme by phoneme practically,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
These poems. It's like, what's going on here? It's like yeah. taking it. I was like, my dad, when I was, I think it was either right before I was born or when I was really little, he had an Alfa Romeo, you know, one of those little sports cars.
My mom had one too.
Right. And he and my uncle Joe took it apart. Because they were going to put it back together again, and then they couldn't put it back together.
Of course they couldn't. Yeah, of course.
So, but it was that impulse to like dismantle
yeah.
something. Like, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, certain poems that I've lived with my, you know, entire like life as a writer, and just dismantle them and be like, what is actually happening here?
Yeah.
You know, and like, and you know, so that was, I think, great for my own sense of like what's possible in poems. And also just, you know, for me, I don't know if it's true for other people, but for me, the more I'm writing, the better I write. So that goes for prose, that goes for, I mean, even sometimes for emails, you know, if I'm like, not this boring emails, but like, you know, if I'm like writing you an email or something, I spend 20 minutes doing it. It's like still writing, you know?
Totally.
So I don't really like, you know, I don't really like, for me, it doesn't take anything away. It just, no. I'm keeping up my chops. You know, but I'm always keeping up my chops because, like, I mean, I I'm not always good about this, but you know, Matt Rohr and I have been collaborating on poems for we've been doing it for I want to say like over a year, and we write back and forth every day. And I probably shouldn't even be talking about it because it's like just completely private work. But I was just thinking about, you know, he and I are like emailing each other 20 times a day, collaborating, and so we're just it's not for publication. It's not we're just keeping up our technique, basically.
Yeah, you know? And I think having like one person that you do that with on email is like a game changer for like a poet to keep, you know. It's like, yeah, it doesn't have to be this precious thing where every poem's like a winner. Like, you can just like,
no, but you're doing it on the line level. You're almost doing it on the word level. I mean, that's why collaborating is so great, because, and Matt is a fucking genius, and he does shit. He regularly does shit that's just like mind blowing. And so, you know, so he'll do it, and I'm like, I gotta step up, and I have to turn this line back around, you know, and it has to be as good, or it has to be better. And I have to be like, I have to, you know, or I have to mess with him. I have to make it harder for him this next line. So how am I gonna do that? Like, and so I'm always, you know, between that and with my email, I mean, I hate email, obviously, like any sane human being, I hate email. I'm like, but I also think of my emails, I always try to make them interesting to myself to write.
Right.
So, you know, so I'm like, to me, I'm like, if I can make this practice, or I can make this, you know, there's something in there, some little phrase or some little moment that I kind of like fuck around, or just like, or just try to turn around, you know. That's, I'm just like trying to always be working, because like you know, you have a kid, I have a kid. It's like, it's ridiculous, the amount of demands. And so you have to try to find your work where you can, right?
Yeah, and it's really dangerous to think that you can't have both, you know, that you have to choose like some sort of domestic like servitude over over creativity, you know. And so
I mean, also kids, whatever, we don't even talk about kids, but like, you know, but it's sure, they bring a lot of that creativity and a lot of that like life that you wouldn't otherwise have, but they also drain you like and destroy every ounce of your like self. so you know, you got to fight back against that too, you know, while also loving them, right. So it's you know, but I think poets, that's the nice thing about poetry, is like it's a place where you can, like, kept circling back around to something I was saying before, I think it is a place where you can push back in a way that isn't violent, or it isn't reactive, or it doesn't take away from somebody else, or it doesn't hurt somebody else. It's like you're pushing back. It's like that great quote from Wallace Stevens, Noble Writer in The Sound of Words, you know, the violence, the imagination is a violence from within that pushes back against the violence from without. You know, and it's like he, you know, you're pushing back, you're creating a space, like you're physically like pushing. And he was like, no, you know, this is not going to get any closer than here. You know, I'm gonna push, you know, that way with the palm. And then I have this space here, you know, to be whatever fucked up person I am. You know? But
I 100% agree.
Well, yeah, for sure. Because that's what your poems do.
Yeah. Well, I would love it if you read us a poem to sing us out.
Sure.
Of your own choosing.
Of my own choosing. Wow. Oh my God. The responsibility. Well, in light of that.
Oh, wait. The new poem.
Oh, I can read that if you want. Yeah. Or maybe, should I read? I can
also read. What are you thinking?
Well, I can read. What would you be embarrassed if I read astrology? Because it has your name in it.
I was going to ask. Yeah.
I'll read it.
Even though you're sort of
remember. No, I'm not dissing you at all. Actually, it's the opposite. I'm like feeling.
Yeah, you're dissing yourself.
But I think this was after I saw you. Was it at Juniper where I saw you?
Yep, it was at Juniper. You came for a reading.
Right. I came for a reading. I was feeling very strange because, you know, that place is, you know, I was an undergrad at Amherst College. And then I went to grad school at UMass and I taught at the Juniper Summer Institute for years and years and years. And that's where I met my wife, Sarah, at
Right.
there. She was in a fiction workshop and I was teaching poetry. And, you know, so, and then I came back and I was just like, oh my God, like no one even knows who I am here. Like this, I don't even belong here anymore. It was so wild.
Oh
It was
shit.
like kind of
So funny
awful.
you were thinking that because I was like, oh, Zapruder's here. I'm so
Well, you and
excited.
me, we know each other. Okay, but
Yeah.
like so me, there were five people there who knew that I who I had a connection with. But like that scene had moved
Yeah.
on, as scenes do, right?
Right,
And
right.
it was like, but it was like I think I was just feeling kind of like, oh, you know.
Yeah, I
But
know. When one is in a mood, there's really nothing you
I
can do
was in a
about it.
mood. So anyway, so I wrote this poem, and Bianca, you appear in it, and also Dottie Lasky, my beloved Dottie, who's, you know. So two great poets are in here. All right, so I'll read it. It's called Astrology. Astrology. Dottie, I hate astrology. And the way you sit there, you and Bianca, looking down on my poems. I can almost hear you thinking, how did he get so old? Why did we ever pretend we liked to listen to his various hues of darkness and occasional pale glows? This is projection, I know. I know you are full of true love for poetry made not just by yourself. And for that, I really do love you. Also, I adore your earrings, the little toy fruits and plates, and your brilliant, terrifying mind. But the way you look down, even though you do not, with the mystics on me, destroys me. Dottie, you are a green jewel. A scary green jewel that can tell the future so much better than astrology, which is really stupid. Though no birds get killed, so I guess it's harmless, unless you let it direct you. But then again, Dottie, your last book made me afraid to be a mother. I add it to all the others, the real fears about my son. I will tell you sometime how different he is. It causes me to marvel. Even when I feel the fears, I imagine them in some part of my mind. Let us not call it the library. Let us call it the door. Dottie, your poems make me want to open it. For a long time now, truth has been a ridiculous word. For what power guides my mind, half asleep, pushing me further where I am so afraid to go? Dottie, you've seen my chart. So you know I was born on the terrible cusp of reason and dream. And there I will always remain, waving at you as you pass in your green craft, knowing you will return.
Matthew, thank you so much. There's so much I wanted to ask you on top of this, but we'll just have to talk again too.
We'll do it again. We'll do it again. It's great to talk to
It's
you,
just,
Bianca.
yeah.
Yeah.
I got what you do for poetry. I'm deeply grateful.
Well, I feel the same way about you, and I can't wait to see your spot in Goshen,
Oh
land of Goshen.
yeah. If we can get you back on the right side of the country.
Okay, I'll get there. I'll get there. All
Yeah,
right. Well, I'm
you're.
sending love to you and Ben.
Yeah.
And you know, it's great. Thanks for talking to me. And you know, let's do it again.